a few tons of manure, maybe a few gallons of ladybugs. The organic farmer's focus is on a process rather than on products. Nor is that process readily systematized, reduced to, say, a prescribed regimen of sprayings like the one Danny Forsyth laid out for me. Regimens that are typically designed by companies selling chemicals. Most of the intelligence and local knowledge needed to run Mike Heath's farm resides in the head of Mike Heath. Growing potatoes conventionally requires intelligence too, but a larger portion of it resides in laboratories in distant places such as St. Louis, where it is employed developing inputs like Roundup or the New Leaf. This sort of centralization of agriculture is not likely to be reversed anytime soon, if only because there's so much money in it, and, in the short run at least, it's so much easier for the farmer to buy pre-packaged solutions from big companies. Whose head is the farmer using? Asks the title of a Wendell Berry essay. Whose head is using the farmer? At a certain point, a point already long past, the farmer's attempt at the perfect control of nature evolved into the control of the farmer by the corporations that promoted that dream in the first place. It is only because that dream is so elusive that the control of farmers by its merchants became so inescapable. Organic farmers like Mike Heath have turned their backs on what is unquestionably the greatest strength and still greater weakness of industrial agriculture, monoculture, and the economies of scale it makes possible. Monoculture is the single most powerful simplification of modern agriculture, the key move in reconfiguring nature as a machine. Yet nothing else in agriculture is so poorly fitted to the way nature seems to work. Very simply, a vast field of identical plants will always be exquisitely vulnerable to insects, weeds, and disease, to all the vicissitudes of nature. Monoculture is at the root of virtually every problem that bedevils the modern farmer, and from which virtually every agricultural product is designed to deliver him. To put the matter baldly, a farmer like Mike Heath is working hard to adjust his fields to the logic of nature, while Danny Forsyth is working even harder to adjust his fields to the logic of monoculture, and, standing behind that, the logic of an industrial food chain. One small case in point. When I asked Mike Heath what he did about net necrosis, the bane of Danny Forsyth's potato crop, I was disarmed by the simplicity of his answer. That's only really a problem with russet Burbanks, he explained. So I plant other kinds. Forsyth can't do that. He's part of a food chain, at the far end of which stands a perfect McDonald's French fry that demands he grow russet Burbanks and nothing else. This, of course, is where biotechnology comes in, to the rescue of Forsyth's russet Burbanks and, Monsanto is betting, to the whole industrial food chain of which they form a part. Monoculture is in crisis. The pesticides that make it possible are rapidly being lost, either to resistance or to worries about their dangers. As the fertility of the soil has declined under the onslaught of chemicals, so too in many places have crop yields. We need a new silver bullet, an entomologist with the Oregon Extension Service told me, and biotech is it. Yet a new silver bullet is not the same thing as a new paradigm. Rather, it's something that will allow the old paradigm to survive. That paradigm will always construe the problem in Danny Forsyth's field as a Colorado beetle problem, rather than what it is. A problem of potato monoculture. What Mike Heath's answer to my question about net necrosis, that's only really a problem with russet Burbanks, suggests is that the problem of monoculture may itself be as much a problem of culture as it is of agriculture. Which is to say, it's a problem in which all of us are implicated, not just farmers and companies like Monsanto. I was starting to appreciate that the conventional journalistic narrative that usually organizes a story like this, evil technology foisted by greedy corporation, leaves out an important element, which is us and our desire for control and uniformity. So much of what I'd seen in Idaho, from the clean fields to the computer-controlled crop circles, goes back to that perfect McDonald's French fry at the eating end of the food chain. On my way back to Boise, I did a drive-through at a McDonald's and ordered a bag of the fries in question. There's no way of knowing for sure, but these fries may well have been my second meal of New Leafs in a day. At the time, McDonald's used New Leafs in its French fries. A Monsanto executive had told me that without McDonald's early support, the New Leaf might never have gotten off the ground, since McDonald's is one of the largest buyers of potatoes in the world. Recently, McDonald's and several other large food companies, responding to growing public unease about genetically modified food, have stopped using genetically modified crops in their products. The loss of McDonald's support appears to have doomed the New Leaf potato. Monsanto announced in early 2001 that the product would be discontinued the following year. Acreage planted to other GMO crops continues to increase, though at a slower rate. You know, their fries really are gorgeous. Slender golden rectangles long enough to overshoot their trim red containers like a bouquet. A farmer had told me that only the russet Burbank will give you a fry quite that long and perfect. To look at them is to appreciate that these aren't just French fries. They're platonic ideals of French fries, the image and the food rolled into one, and available anywhere in the world for around $1 a bag. You can't beat it. I wanted and fully expected to find precisely the same platonic French fry here in Nowhere, Idaho, that I'd had countless times at home and could expect to find any time I wanted to in Tokyo, Paris, Beijing, Moscow, even Azerbaijan or the Isle of Man. What is that if not a control thing? And not just on the part of McDonald's. But whatever is behind it, this expectation can't be fulfilled unless McDonald's has seen to it that millions of acres of russet Burbanks are planted all over the world. The global desire can't be gratified without the global monoculture, and that global monoculture now depends on technologies like genetic engineering. It just may be that we can't have the one without the other. This alignment of global desire and technology has been a great boon for the russet Burbank, at least in terms of sheer numbers. Has there ever been a more successful potato in the history of the world? Yet its success is a precarious thing, for this particular set of potato genes, or rather now, potato genes plus one BT gene and one antibiotic resistance gene, courtesy of Monsanto, has also never been more vulnerable to the vicissitudes of nature or the fecklessness of a single species, us. Whether in evolutionary terms a monoculture really represents long-term success for a species is an open question. The lumper, Ireland's favorite potato before the famine, was once nearly as dominant as the russet Burbank. Today, its genes are as hard to find as the dodo's. Part of the pleasure those fries gave me was how perfectly they conformed to my image and expectation of them. To the idea of fries in my head, that is, an idea that McDonald's has successfully planted in the heads of a few billion other people around the world. Here, then, is a whole other meaning of the word monoculture. Like the agricultural practice that goes by that name, this one, too, the monoculture of global taste, is about uniformity and control. Indeed, the monocultures of the field and the monocultures of our global economy nourish each other in crucial ways. The two are complexly intertwined expressions of the same Apollonian desire. Our impulse, I mean, to elevate the universal over the particular or local, the abstract over the concrete, the ideal over the real, the made over the natural. The spirit of Apollo celebrates the one, Plutarch wrote, denying the many and abjuring multiplicity. Against Dionysus's variability and wantonness, he poses the power of uniformity and orderliness. Apollo is the god, then, of monoculture, whether of plants or of people. And though Apollo has surely had many more exalted manifestations than this one, he is here, too. in every bag of McDonald's French fries. Ireland, 1846. On the 27th of last month, July, I passed from Cork to Dublin, and this doomed plant bloomed in all luxuriance of an abundant harvest. So begins a letter written in the summer of 1846 by a Catholic priest named Father Matthew. Returning on the 3rd of August, I beheld with sorrow one wide waste of putrefying vegetation. In many places the wretched people were seated on the fences of their decaying gardens, wringing their hands and wailing bitterly the destruction that had left them foodless. The arrival of the blight was announced by the stench of rotting potatoes, a stench that became general in Ireland late in the summer of 1845, then again in 46 and 48. Its spores carried on the wind, the fungus would appear in a field literally overnight. A black spotting of the leaves followed by a gangrenous stain spreading down the plant's stem. Then the blackened tubers would turn to evil-smelling slime. It took but a few days for the fungus to scorch a green field black. Even potatoes in storage succumbed. The potato blight visited all of Europe, but only in Ireland did it produce a catastrophe. Elsewhere, people could turn to other staple foods when a crop failed, but Ireland's poor, subsisting on potatoes and exiled from the cash economy, had no alternative. As is often the case in times of starvation, the problem was not quite so simple as a shortage of food. At the height of the famine, Ireland's docks were heaped with sacks of corn destined for export to England. But the corn was a commodity, determined to follow the money. Since the potato eaters had no money to pay for corn, it sailed for a country that did. The potato famine was the worst catastrophe to befall Europe since the Black Death of 1348. Ireland's population was literally decimated. One in every eight Irishmen, 1 million people, died of starvation in 3 years. Thousands of others went blind or insane for lack of the vitamins potatoes had supplied. Because the poor laws made anyone who owned more than a quarter acre of land ineligible for aid, millions of Irish were forced to give up their farms in order to eat. Uprooted and desperate, the ones with the energy and wherewithal emigrated to America. Within a decade, Ireland's population was halved and the composition of America's population permanently altered. Contemporary accounts of the potato famine read like visions of hell. Streets piled with corpses no one had the strength to bury. Armies of near-naked beggars who'd pawned their clothes for food. Abandoned houses, deserted villages. Disease followed on famine. Typhus, cholera, and purpura raced unchecked through the weakened population. People ate weeds, ate pets, ate human flesh. "The roads are beset with tattered skeletons," one witness wrote. God help the people. The causes of Ireland's calamity were complex and manifold, involving such things as the distribution of land, brutal economic exploitation by the English, and a relief effort by turns heartless and hapless, as well as the usual accidents of climate, geography, and cultural habit. Yet this whole edifice of contingency rested at bottom upon a plant, or more precisely, upon the relationship between a plant and a people. For it was not the potato so much as potato monoculture that sowed the seeds of Ireland's disaster. Indeed, Ireland's was surely the biggest experiment in monoculture ever attempted, and surely the most convincing proof of its folly. Not only did the agriculture and diet of the Irish come to depend utterly on the potato, but they depended almost completely on one kind of potato. The lumper. Potatoes, like apples, are clones, which means that every lumper was genetically identical to every other lumper, all of them descended from a single plant that just happened to have no resistance to Phytophthora infestans. The Incas, too, built a civilization atop the potato, but they cultivated such a polyculture of potatoes that no one fungus could ever have toppled it. In fact, it was to South America that, in the aftermath of the famine, breeders went to look for potatoes that could resist the blight. And there, in a potato called the Garnet Chile, they found it. Monoculture is where the logic of nature collides with the logic of economics. Which logic will ultimately prevail can never be in doubt. In Ireland, under British rule, the logic of economics dictated a monoculture of potatoes. In 1845, the logic of nature exercised its veto, and a million people, many of whom probably owed their existence to the potato in the first place, perished. As for their command over nature, wrote Benjamin Disraeli in his 1847 novel Tancred, let us see how it will operate in a second deluge. Command over nature. Why, the humblest root that serves for the food of man has mysteriously withered throughout Europe, and they are already pale at the possible consequences. In March 1998, patent number 5723765, describing a novel method for the control of plant gene expression, was granted jointly to the U.S. Department of Agriculture and a cottonseed company called Delta and Pine Land. The bland language of the patent obscures a radical new genetic technology. Introduced into any plant, the gene in question causes the seeds that plant makes to become sterile, to no longer do what seeds have always done. With the Terminator, as the new technique quickly became known, genetic engineers have discovered how to stop on command the most elemental of nature's processes. The plant-seed-plant-seed cycle by which plants reproduce and evolve. The ancient logic of the seed, to freely make more of itself ad infinitum, to serve as both food and the means of making more food in the future, has yielded to the modern logic of capitalism. Now, viable seeds will come not from plants, but from corporations. The dream of controlling the seed, and through the seed, the farmer, is older than genetic engineering. It goes back at least to the development, in a handful of crops, of modern hybrids, high-yielding varieties that don't come true from replanted seed, thereby forcing farmers to buy new seeds every spring. Yet compared to the rest of the economy, farming has largely resisted the trend towards centralization and corporate control. Even today, when only a handful of big companies are left standing in most American industries, there are still some 2 million farmers. What has stood in the way of concentration is nature. Her complexity, diversity, and sheer intractability in the face of our most heroic efforts at control. Perhaps most intractable of all has been agriculture's means of production, which, of course, is nature's own, the seed. It's only in the last few decades, with the introduction of modern hybrids, that farmers began to buy their seeds from big companies. Even today, a great many farmers save some seed every fall to replant in the spring. Brown bagging, as this practice is sometimes called, allows farmers to select strains particularly well adapted to local conditions. Worldwide, it's estimated that some 1.4 billion people depend on saved seed. Since these seeds are typically traded among farmers, the practice steadily advances the state of the genetic art. Indeed, over centuries, it has given us most of our major crop plants. Infinitely reproducible, seeds by their very nature don't lend themselves to commodification, which is why the genetics of most of our major crop plants have traditionally been regarded as a common heritage rather than as intellectual property. In the case of the potato, the genetics of the important varieties, the Russet Burbanks and Atlantic Superiors, the Kennebecs and Red Norlings, have always been in the public domain. Before Monsanto got involved, there had never been a national corporation in the potato seed business. There simply wasn't enough money in it. Genetic engineering changes this. By adding a new gene or two to a russet or a superior, Monsanto can now patent the improved variety. Legally, it's been possible to patent a plant for several years now, but biologically, these patents have been almost impossible to enforce. Genetic engineering has gone a long way toward solving this problem, since it allows Monsanto to test the potato plants growing on a farm to prove they're the company's intellectual property. The contracts farmers must sign to buy Monsanto seeds grant the company the right to perform such tests at will, even in future years. To catch farmers violating its patent rights, Monsanto has reportedly paid informants and hired Pinkertons to track down gene thieves. It has already sued hundreds of farmers for patent infringement. With a technology such as the Terminator, the company will no longer have to go to all that trouble. I say such as the Terminator because after an international barrage of criticism, Monsanto has forsworn the technology. However, it is not forsworn a group of related technologies that achieve the same end. Genetic use restriction technologies, GURT, which make it possible to turn genetic traits on and off by applying certain proprietary chemicals to genetically modified plants in the field. So even if the plant in question still produces viable seed, those seeds will produce worthless plants. Plants with their disease or herbicide resistance turned off, unless the farmer buys the chemical activator. With the Terminator, seed companies can enforce their patents biologically and indefinitely. Once these genes are widely introduced, control over the genetics of our crop plants and the trajectory of their evolution will complete its move from the farmer's field to the seed company, to which the world's farmers will have no choice but to return year after year. The Terminator allows companies like Monsanto to enclose one of the last great commons in nature, the genetics of the crop plants that civilization has developed over the past 10,000 years. At lunch, I had asked Steve Young what he thought about all this, especially about the contract Monsanto forces him to sign and the prospect of sterile seeds. I wondered how the American farmer, the putative heir to a long tradition of agrarian independence, was adjusting to the idea of field men snooping around his farm and patented seeds he couldn't replant. Young told me he'd made his peace with corporate agriculture, and with biotechnology in particular. It's here to stay. It's necessary if we're going to feed the world, and it's going to take us forward. I asked him if he saw any downside to biotechnology. Someone from Monsanto was with us at the table. Young's reply was a long time in coming, and the moment grew uncomfortable. What he finally said silenced the table and made me think again about the image of mastery he'd projected, about the computer-controlled fields, the chemical distributorship, the miles of patented high-tech spuds framed in his living room's picture window, reaching clear to the horizon. "Oh, there is a cost, all right," Young said darkly. "It gives corporate America one more noose around my neck." August. A few weeks after I got home from Idaho, I dug my new leaves, harvesting a gorgeous-looking pile of spuds, several real lunkers among them. The plants had performed brilliantly, though so had all my other potatoes. The beetle problem never got out of hand, perhaps because the diversity of species in my garden had attracted enough beneficial insects to check the bugs. Who knows? My scapegoat tomatillos may also have helped. The fact is, a true test of my new leaves would have meant planting a monoculture. By the time I harvested my crop, the question of eating my new leaves was moot. Whatever I thought about the safety of these potatoes really didn't matter. Not just because I'd already tasted Mrs. Young's new leaf potato salad, but because Monsanto and my government had long ago taken the decision as to whether or not to eat a biotech spud out of my hands. Chances are I've eaten plenty of new leaves already, at McDonald's or in bags of Frito-Lay chips, though without a label, there's no way of knowing for sure. So if I've eaten probable new leaves already, why was it I kept putting off eating these definite new leaves? Maybe just because it was August and there were so many more interesting fresh potatoes around. Fingerlings with dense, luscious flesh, Yukon Golds, Mike Heath's as well as my own, that looked and tasted as though they'd been buttered in the skin. that the idea of cooking with the sort of bland commercial variety Monsanto puts its genes into seemed almost beside the point. There was this, too. I'd called some of the government agencies in Washington that had signed off on the New Leaf, and what they said didn't exactly fill me with confidence. The Food and Drug Administration told me that, because it operates on the assumption that genetically modified plants are substantially equivalent to ordinary plants, the regulation of these foods has been voluntary since 1992. Only if Monsanto feels there is a safety concern is it required to consult with the agency about its New Leafs. I'd always assumed the FDA had tested the new potato, maybe fed a bunch of them to rats, but it turned out this was not the case. In fact, the Food and Drug Administration doesn't even officially regard the New Leaf as a food. What? It seems that since the potato contains BT, it is, at least in the eyes of the federal government, not a food at all, but a pesticide, putting it under the jurisdiction of the Environmental Protection Agency. Feeling a bit like Alice in a bureaucratic wonderland, I phoned the EPA to ask about my potatoes. As the EPA sees it, BT has always been a safe pesticide. The potato has always been a safe food. So put the two together and you've got something that should be safe both to eat and to kill bugs with. Evidently, the machine metaphor has won the day in Washington, too. The New Leaf is simply the sum of its parts. A safe gene added to a safe potato. I also phoned Margaret Mellon at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C. to ask her advice about my spuds. Mellon is a molecular biologist and lawyer and a leading critic of biotech agriculture. She couldn't offer any hard scientific proof that my New Leafs were unsafe to eat, but she pointed out that there was also no scientific proof for the notion of substantial equivalence. That research simply hasn't been done. In fact, internal documents that have come to light as part of a consumer suit against the FDA reveal that several of the agency's own scientists also reject the notion of substantial equivalence. Mellon talked about genetic instability, a phenomenon which strongly suggests that a biotech plant is not simply the sum of its old and new genes. And she talked about the fact that we know nothing about the effect of BT in the human diet. A place it has never been before. I pressed. Was there any reason why I shouldn't eat these spuds? Let me ask you a question. Why would you want to? This was a good question. So for several weeks late that summer, my New Leafs remained in a shopping bag on the porch. Then I took the bag with me on vacation, thinking maybe I'd sample them there. But the bag came home untouched. Except, that is, for one potato I'd taken out of it. A fishmonger had told me about a Martha Stewart tip for keeping grilled fish from sticking to a barbecue. Rub the grill with a raw potato sliced down the middle. It works, by the way. But I was still left with my bag of New Leafs sitting there on the porch. And there they sat until Labor Day, when I got an invitation to a potluck supper at the town beach. Perfect. I signed up to make a potato salad. The day of the supper, I brought the bag of spuds into the kitchen and set a pot of water on the stove. But before the water even had a chance to boil, I was stricken by this obvious thought. Wouldn't I have to tell people at the picnic what they were eating? I had no reason to think the potatoes weren't perfectly safe, but if the idea of eating genetically modified food without knowing it gave me pause, I couldn't very well ask my neighbors to do so. That would be rather more potluck than they were counting on. So, of course, I'd have to tell them all about the New Leafs, and then, no doubt, bring home a big bowl of untouched potato salad. For surely there'd be other potato salads at the potluck, and who, given the choice, was ever going to opt for the one with the biotech spuds? I suddenly understood, with perfect clarity, why Monsanto doesn't want to label its genetically modified food. So I turned down the flame under the pot and went out to the garden to harvest a pile of ordinary spuds for my potato salad. The New Leafs went back out into the limbo of my porch. Epilogue. I hadn't been in the garden for a couple of weeks, and, as always is the case by the end of the summer, the place was an anarchy of rampant growth and ripe fruit, all of it threatening to burst the geometry of my beds and trellises and paths. The pole beans had climbed clear to the tops of the sunflowers, which stood draped in their bulging green and yellow pods. The pumpkins had trailed halfway across the now unmowable lawn, and the squash leaves, big as pizzas, threw dark pools of shade in which the lettuces looked extremely happy, as unfortunately did the slugs who were dining on my chard in the squashy shade. The vines of the last potatoes lay flopped over their hills, exhausted. The garden had come to this, had reached this pitch of green uproar in the few short weeks since May, when I'd set out seedlings in a considered pattern I no longer could discern. The neat, freshly hoed rows had once implied that I was in charge here, the gardener in chief, but clearly this was no longer the case. My order had been overturned as the plants went blithely about their plant destinies. This they were doing with the avidity of all annuals, reaching for the sun, seizing ground from neighbors, fending off or exploiting one another whenever the opportunity arose, ripening the seeds that would bear their genes into the future, and generally making the most of the dwindling days till frost. For a while every season, I do try to keep the whole thing under some semblance of control, pulling the weeds, clipping back the squash so that the chard might breathe, untangling the bean vines before they choke their frailer neighbors. But by the end of August, I usually give it up, let the garden go its own way while I simply try to keep up with the abundance of the late summer harvest. By this point, what's going on in the garden is no longer my doing, even if it was I who got the whole thing rolling back in May. As much as I love the firm grasp and cerebral order of spring, there's a ripe, almost sensual pleasure in its August abandonment, too. But I'd come here looking for something, and eventually I found it. A row of kennebecs, their tops already sprawled dead on the ground. One of the many virtues of potatoes is that they can be left in the ground all winter, to be dug only as needed. Historically, this has been a great blessing to peasants subject to marauding armies, since potatoes in the ground can't very well be ransacked. I think there is no harvest more satisfying than the harvest of potatoes. I love the moment when the spade turns over the crust of black soil for the first time since spring, and the chino-colored lumps tumble out onto the fresh dirt. After gathering up the first flush of easy ones, you should lay the spade aside, or else you're apt to bruise the remaining potatoes. Go for the rest by hand, forcing your fingers down into the richly manured soil, feeling around in the dark for those unmistakable forms, the identity of which the hand has no need of the eye to confirm. That's because potatoes are always cooler to the touch than stone. Heavier, too, and somehow always a happier fit in the hand. Not that any given spud is ever such a paragon of form. No two of them ever alike. Most potatoes are odd, misshapen, asymmetrical things, their shapes determined as much by the accidents of adjacent rocks and soil as by any genetic instruction followed to the letter. Maybe this is why we like to give our thonic spuds such sunny and Apollonian forms, slicing them into translucent chips and geometrical fries. Yet compared to the undifferentiated night in which they grow, the bright potatoes feel in the hand like form incarnate. Sooner or later your fingers close on that one moist, cold spud that the spade has accidentally sliced clean through, shining wetly white and giving off the most unearthly of earthly aromas. It's the smell of fresh soil in the spring, but fresh soil somehow distilled or improved upon, as if that wild, primordial scene had been refined and bottled, eau de pomme de terre. You can smell the cold, inhuman earth in it, but there's the cozy kitchen, too, for the smell of potatoes is, at least by now, to us, the smell of comfort itself. A smell as blankly welcoming as spud flesh. A whiteness that takes up memories and sentiments as easily as flavors. To smell a raw potato is to stand on the very threshold of the domestic and the wild. Once I'd filled a basket with my spuds, I stood and considered the state of the garden, the daunting magnificence of its declension from May's straightforward rows and intentions. Whenever I hear or read the word garden, I always picture something so much less wild than this, probably because in common usage, garden stands as the opposite of wilderness. The gardener knows better than to believe this, though. He knows that his garden fence and path and cherished geometries hold in their precarious embrace, if not a wilderness in any literal sense, then surely a great teeming effulgence of wildness, of plants and animals and microbes leading their multifarious lives, proposing so many different and unexpected answers to the deep pulse of their genes and the wide press of their surroundings, of everything affecting everything else. So where exactly does that leave us, the gardeners and descendants of Johnny Appleseed, who would try to make something of this wildness? Standing amid this sweet wreck of a garden this August afternoon, lifting a basket heavy with potatoes, I thought about Chapman in his coffee sack, about the fanatical tulip fanciers and pot growers of Amsterdam, about the Monsanto scientists in their lab coats, and wondered what they had in common. All of them had ventured into the garden, into Darwin's ever-expanding garden of artificial selection, for the purpose of marrying powerful human drives to the equally powerful drives of plants. All were practitioners of the botany of desire. In the nature of things, this made them, Chapman-like, potato-like, figures of the margins, moving between the realms of the wild and the cultivated, the anciently given and the newly made, the Dionysian and the Apollonian. All of them had taken part in the great, never-to-be-concluded conversation between those two presiding deities, adding their 2 cents to the dialogue of Dionysian energy and Apollonian order that has produced the beauty of a Queen of Night tulip, the sweetness of a Jonna Gold apple, the perception sponsored in a human brain by Cannabis Sativa Indica. Somewhere between those two poles, all gardeners, indeed, all of us, stake out their ground. Some of them, like Appleseed, leaning to the side of Dionysian wildness. He'd love this garden now. Others, like the scientists at Monsanto, pushing toward the Apollonian satisfactions of control. The lab coats would probably have liked the garden better earlier in the season, before all hell broke loose. Still others are harder to place on the continuum. I mean, where exactly do you put the marijuana grower tending his hydroponic closet of clones, that Apollonian edifice dedicated to the pursuit of Dionysian pleasure? It's a good thing one doesn't have to take sides. With the exception of John Chapman, who had the imagination to identify with the bees, all these other botanists of desire went about their work from a straightforward and, it seems to me, blinkered humanist perspective. They took it for granted that domestication was something people did to plants, never the other way around. It probably never occurred to Dr. Adrian Poe, the Dutch burgher who owned 11/12 or 12/13 of the world's population of Semper Augustus tulips, that those tulips, in some sense, owned him. That he'd devoted the better part of his life to advancing their numbers and happiness. But the tulipomania he unwittingly helped fire was an inestimable boon to the genus Tulipa, which may be said to have had the last laugh. Its fortunes, at least, have been ascendant in the world ever since the Dutch burghers lost their fortunes on its account. Witting or not, all these characters have been actors in a coevolutionary drama. A dance of human and plant desire that has left neither the plants nor the people taking part in it unchanged. Okay, desire might be too strong a word for whatever it is that drives plants to reinvent themselves so that we might do their bidding. But then, our own designs have often been no more willful than the plants. We too cast unconscious evolutionary votes every time we reach for the most symmetrical flower or the longest French fry. The survival of the sweetest, the most beautiful, or the most intoxicating proceeds according to a dialectical process, a give and take between human desire and the universe of all plant possibility. It takes two, but it doesn't take intention or consciousness. I keep coming back to that image of John Chapman floating down the Ohio River, snoozing alongside his mountain of apple seeds. Seeds that held sleeping within them the apple's American future, the golden age to come. The barefoot crank knew something about how things stand between us and the plants, something we seem to have lost sight of in the two centuries since. He understood, I think, that our destinies on the river of natural history are twined. And while I personally don't think he was right to judge grafting a wickedness, his judgment does bespeak an instinctive feeling for the necessity of wildness and the value of multiplicity over monoculture. Though Chapman would probably disagree, genetic engineering is probably no more wicked than grafting, though it too wars against wildness and multiplicity, albeit much more fiercely. It too places its bet, a very large bet, on the Apollonian one as against the Dionysian many. The new leaf marks an evolutionary turn that may or may not take us somewhere we want to be. Just in case it doesn't, though, we'd be wise to follow Chapman's example, to save and seed all manner of plant genes. The wild, the unpatentable, even the seemingly useless, patently ugly, and just plain strange. Next year, in place of the new leaf, I plan to plant a great many different old leaves. Instead of one perfect potato, I'll make Chapman's bet on the field. To shrink the sheer diversity of life, as the grafters and monoculturists and genetic engineers would do, is to shrink evolution's possibilities, which is to say, the future open to all of us. This is the assembly of life that it took a billion years to evolve, the zoologist E.O. Wilson has written, speaking of biodiversity. It has eaten the storms, folded them into its genes, and created the world that created us. It holds the world steady. To risk this multiplicity is to risk unstringing the world. Biodiversity is a word that was not in John Chapman's vocabulary, though it's a good one to describe the crazy archive of apple genes he had with him that summer afternoon on the Ohio. His view of our place in nature was eccentric even by the standards of his day. But I'm convinced that there is some usable truth there, if not in his words, then certainly in his deeds. I'm thinking specifically of the way he rigged up his canoe that day, the two hulls side by side, so that the weight of the apple seeds balanced the weight of the man, each helping to keep the other steady on the river. Laughable as an example of naval architecture, perhaps, but seaworthy, surely, as a metaphor. Chapman's craft, his example, invites us to imagine a very different kind of story about man and nature. One that shrinks the distance between the two, so that we might again begin to see them for what they are, and in spite of everything, will always be. Which is in this boat, together.
This has been an Audio Evolution production of The Botany of Desire. Recorded at North Hollywood Sound. Post-production by Pete Pentelis. Copyright 2001 by Michael Pollan. Production copyright 2006 by Audio Evolution, LLC. All rights reserved.